Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hi everyone, it's Fet Mascara. I'm Jen. Happy April, happy almost spring here in the Northern Hemisphere. I hope you're all doing well and that you enjoyed my guest co-host, Alexandra Pauly, who was here on Wednesday. I know it's Friday, it's interview day. I am working on some amazing Friday interviews for the next upcoming weeks. So we have an acupuncturist coming on. We're going to talk about allergies and how they affect how you look. We have a sustainability expert to talk about beauty packaging, but as I'm gearing up for all of that, I thought you might like a little infusion of Miss Jessica Matlin's voice and point of view. So today's episode is a flashback. It's her interview with makeup artist Dick Page, truly one of my favorite Fat Mascara interviews. Dick is, of course, a legendary makeup artist and artistic director. He's done pretty much every runway show, including Hermes, Jacquemus, Michael Kors, and he's done ads for Yves Saint Laurent, Miu Miu, Gap, lots of magazine covers. He's just a legend and a delight to hang out with. So I will leave the virtual studio to him and Jess. Enjoy.
Where am I speaking to you in? You look like you're in a little attic or something.
Now, this is upstairs in the house on Long Island. It's a very old house, 1738. It's built.
Oh, nice.
It's like a little shed.
A little shed.
Like storage to one side of the clothes are all hanging up there. So we've just sold a house and we're moving, supposedly moving. But in the meantime, we're mostly staying out here because it's nice and there's a long garden for the dogs and stuff.
I know. You have one dog or two dogs?
We have two dogs.
Okay. So are you mostly out of the city now?
Well, we moved to Brooklyn in 2019 and have been going back and forth, but we put the house on the market in Brooklyn to sell to potentially move back to the city. And so we've mostly been on Long Island. I've been taking the train in and out for work and, you know, just it's all, you know, like everything's up in the air at the moment.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. So tell me, I have to know, how did you find your way into beauty? Let's start with a little bit of an origin story.
My Marvel villain story. You probably had some version of this. I started, like most people who DIY'd it, I started doing my friends' makeup and hair, and we made each other's clothes, post-punk, new romantic thing, end of the 70s, early 80s in England, and got into it. I liked the magazines at the time. I liked all the bands at the time. That was my big inspiration, was the way people looked in bands. And
what kind of bands?
I had all my punk girl. I was very into Susie, and obviously Susie the Banshees and Polystyrene and the Slits and all those kind of. And you know, Blondie, naturally Debbie Harry, the American import, and you know all of those versions of the way people looked, and also the girls at the clubs and at the gigs. Just I liked the way that people made themselves, created themselves with the hair and the clothes and everything. And so I just got into the way that looked. It never occurred to me that was a real job apart until I started looking at magazines and saw, oh, it says that someone did the makeup. Or someone did the hair, whatever, and found that out. Then I decided to have a go, and I did a bunch of stuff for little magazines in Bristol, it's my hometown, the west of England, southwest of England. But I moved to London in 87 and started testing and meeting a bunch of people and just doing photo tests like everyone does or did back then. Mm-hmm. And I met Jürgen Teller in 1987. I met Melanie Ward, stylist Melanie, around the same time. Started working with her a bunch of different stuff. And then worked with Nigel Schaffer, and then I started working with Melanie, with Corinne Day, and with David Sims.
And these are big photographers for...
They're big photographers now, but they weren't then. So yeah, they're big photographers, and Corinne passed away, sadly, a while ago. But, you know, David is, you know, very, very well established in the industry, some of the leading lights in the industry. But at the time, we were all sort of starting together. So that's kind of key, I think, is that you tend to fall in with the tribe that you're either thinking along the same lines as, or you have the same frames of reference as, or you're talking about the same kind of ideas, or you can develop the ideas together. So working with those people, and David started getting a lot of attention, Corin got some attention, started doing things, coming to New York to do things like Barney's, and then Calvin with David. And then in 93, Polly Hamilton, who was a stylist at Calvin Klein at the time, tapped me and Guido, I think also with Fabian Baron, who was creative director, art director, polymath, Fabian, who was doing everything with Calvin at the time. And they got me and Guido in to do the show. That was my first proper fashion show ever. And I was back and forth, and I moved to New York properly 94, 95. It's all woolly, because I was going back and forth. I had a sublet and this and that and the other. So, and here I am still, having moved into New York with a one-month sublet, still here.
Wow. And did you ever have dreams of being into fashion? Like, did this all kind of, it all kind of seems like it just kind of happened. But, you know, I look in my email, like I look at my, just before we got online, I was going to look for my questions for you. And it was like, masterclass, meet your masterclass instructor, Kris Jenner. And it's like, everything now is so focused on, you know, finding a way and getting ahead, and there's a path. And, you know, when I talk to somebody like you and you're mentioning all of these other incredible artists, like, you know, we've had Guido on. When I hear stories like that, it almost feels like it doesn't happen like that so much anymore, or our brains are not operating in the same way. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, well, I think the problem is now, God help me, I'm not going to make all these, you can't call people hippies anymore. But the way, I have a problem with what used to be called new agey speak, the way people talk about achieving your goals, your dreams, actualization, manifesting something, this and that. No. This is not how things happen. Maybe they happen if you bang away hard enough and you chase every opportunity down and you push for it. God knows how people manage nowadays, the way that we are crowded out with so much in the world. I mean, social media, of course, didn't exist when I started. You had to hunt for magazines. They weren't always sold where I lived. I think we've been fed a bit of a lie nowadays. The idea that, you know, if you want something hard enough, you have these dreams, you can do anything, you can achieve anything. Not true. Sorry. I don't think it is true. Some people do very well. Some people do achieve supposedly their goals and dreams, and some people don't. I can think of, back when I started, plenty of people were in the same boat as me, as talented or doing what I did or diversions of what I did and working with various people and doing well and then not doing so well and then disappearing or doing, you know, much more high-profile careers than me. But lots of things work in different ways. But I don't think then it wasn't necessarily a lack of ambition, but just it was just a way of being. I didn't have an alternative way of thinking about it. I decided to go and do it. And I was having fun and it seemed like a cool, fun thing to do. That's the best way to get into stuff. You think that's a fun thing I can do that. I'll have a go.
Yeah, I think now it's much more templated, it's kind of templated, and it's a little bit new agey too. The kind of like, if you can see it, you can be it. If you can follow this person, there's so much innocence in how you describe your trajectory, and I don't really see a lot of that today.
I think that, like I said before about the social media thing, largely is because people have to do all their growing up extremely publicly. You don't have a chance to evolve and develop an idea of anything. You don't wait for film to come back, for example. This is a technical thing to think about, how people always used to shoot on film. Wait for the film to come back, edit it, take a look at it. If you're doing something on spec, hopefully someone will take it, somebody likes it. Same thing with creating a makeup idea. If you wanted to reference something, think about a film or a book or another editorial or something you saw in a magazine, you had to go and physically find it. Go to the library or find a book somewhere, look at these things, think about these ideas. You didn't have everything at your fingertips. So, of course, now it's incredibly competitive, as far as I can tell. Or maybe it's just because I'm aware of the competition or see how people are in the fray of the competition, because they have to be. You have to be pushing all the time. You have to constantly, I mean, God help me, I hate the word content. People want content. Content all the time. You know, you've got to be showing the new thing, the now thing, the next thing. Something new on your feed or on your TikTok or on whatever help people... Probably not even TikTok anymore. That's how disconnected I am to most of it. Probably isn't even TikTok. There's probably something else. But that degree of self-promotion and visibility and pushing yourself forward into it didn't exist then, because it didn't have to. If it had to, it would have been there. So
yeah. You mentioned like the references, like, you know, you used to have to be able to go to a, if let's say, you know, one of your peers had this amazing book or this amazing reference or this amazing album.
Yeah.
And they pulled that reference and it'd be like, oh my God, like blew your mind. Well, now everyone has access to every single reference because we all have the universe in our pocket. Do you feel like that has leveled the playing field in any way or not necessarily? I mean, obviously not everyone is as good as everyone else.
It really depends on the final result, on the work, where you take the reference, what you go do with it. If you're slavish about it, all that happens is you sadly remind people of how great the original work was. You know, so I see people, because you can read it, you can see it. I read it all the time. I'm seeing some work, I see an editorial that people are falling over themselves about, and I can think, as you know, as a dinosaur, I can think, well, yeah, okay, that's William Klein. I know where that picture comes from. I know what the original picture is. Mm-hmm. Or I can say that was Nigel Shaffran. I can see, or that was a painting, or that was so-and-so. That's Avedon. But it's not just Avedon. It's Avedon referencing a painting, or it's Stephen Meisel referencing Avedon. There's kind of like, it's like the pecking order and the way that the great big fish is devouring all the little fish all the way down. So, of course, like I said, the ultimate danger is you will just make people think about how great the original work was. Because you can't say, for example, Luna Doniale, like a beautiful, like amazing, amazing pictures of her from the 60s. You can't do them. You can't do that makeup again. You can't do that hair again. Or you can do it. You can do what the hell you want. I don't care. I'm not a social worker. But it's never going to be as beautiful or as interesting. And maybe that's part of the difficulty now. We crowd ourselves out with images. We absorb them and digest them so quickly that we don't get to live with them. We don't get to live with them and take time to appreciate the moment of each picture, particularly because, sadly, we're not looking at print as much as we were. We see everything on a little phone, a little tiny screen.
It's horrible, yeah.
It's reductive in so many ways. We've reduced records to CDs to nothing. So why a record cover anymore? I still like to buy vinyl. I still like to buy some artists I like still issue vinyl. But mostly it's old vinyl, new. The dream of having a record, like putting the record on the player and having the big picture to look at, or looking at a big picture in a magazine, something in print, something at a gallery, something on the wall, a beautiful photography book. We have the great benefit, as you said before, is to have all these references available across the board. But the great disadvantage is they become less special to us. They become less precious.
I see that, like, when I see people flipping through, and like if I'm on the bus or the train and I see people flipping through Instagram so quickly and I'm like, oh my God, if the people who created those images knew how quickly people were flashing through their photographs or their kids' pictures or, you know, these precious things. And it's just like, it's kind of heartbreaking. You know what I mean?
But we're all complicit because we all do it.
Yeah, no, I do it too. It's just like,
people do it to our work. We do it to other people's work. This is part of the problem, actually, that I'm sort of going around this idea of the way the work is nowadays. A big problem for me, at least, is I want to talk to you about this, but I was trying to think about a way to phrase it that makes some kind of sense. It might not make any kind of sense at all.
It's fine.
This idea of smallness. And I'm interested in this idea of smallness, which I was sort of trying to think of as a parallel to like the idea of the slow food movement, that we've done away with subtlety. We've destroyed any notion subtlety with the way that we absorb media and take in information, because the thing that stops people for the most part of their scrolling, whatever they're doing, is the eye-catching thing.
Sadly, the
eye-catching thing tends to be the flashiest, showiest, noisiest, most jarring. A shock is the same as a surprise, and you don't tend to stop or slow down or dwell on a picture that's a beautifully composed, lit picture.
No.
A portrait or a figure in a landscape or something that's...
A look.
You know, there's no room for this smallness. And I think there's something about smallness of idea. I talked to someone a little while ago saying one of the most incredible moments of the way I work, or not the way, I hope the way anyone works, is the moment of application. It's a moment when a colour is being applied to the skin or something moves and you feel the way the texture of the material changes under your hand, or how the blending of something works and what it's doing and how it's changing in the light and how the person looks at that moment. In that way, you almost want people to be able to see something in slow motion, not for detail of application or the perfect wing liner or the perfect contour, because who cares? You're only going to be as good as the last good contour, because they're all the same. But just for the moment of absorption of the information of an idea, you know?
Yeah.
So that's, so, and smallness doesn't, maybe isn't the right word, but that's sort of what I mean.
It's like gestural.
Yeah, it's gestural, and it's a, there's a subtlety of a feeling of a shift in color in the way that I know when I'm designing or working with color, when I create color for a brand or when I'm doing stuff for myself, I know why something that's had a tiny tonal shift into the black from the original color I was working with suddenly makes sense to me and suddenly is the thing I want to see in the way that I would want to see if I was painting or drawing a picture. And I can't tell you why that's right.
I understand what you mean, and I think it takes a certain appreciation and it takes a look that is more than point half a second. And yeah, it's the, it's not a big graphic, bold, eye-catching, slightly shocking, ridiculous. Ridiculous sounds very negative, but you know, it's the opposite of what plays. And yeah. Where does that stuff play? Where does that stuff live? Where does that stuff have a home? And mm-hmm. I don't know. And like, you know, even just to be very transparent, you know, it's like, Jen and I, you know, have this podcast and it's like, we're talking about conversation. Our conversation is about subtlety right now. Does this have a home on Instagram and where we're going to, you know, where it doesn't have like a sassy mm-hmm. pull quote, you know, it's right. a conversation and it's like, where does that audience live? So we are always talking about content, quote unquote, and mm-hmm. where does that content live? It's such an interesting conversation. There's an audience that wants subtlety because mm-hmm. I'm having this conversation with so many different types of people. And I think media is kind of dumbing it down a little bit. That's my feeling.
I think so. And also the tricky part as well, which occurred to me just as we were speaking, is I suppose I have thought about this before, but the idea that subtlety for many people implies, God help us, the word natural beauty with all its millions of connotations, and this idea of invisible beauty or perfection, or she doesn't look like she's wearing makeup, or this and that and the other. And these strange, also like they're really bound up in personal sexual economic politics of the way that people look and how we're supposed to address these various, you know, the pommel horses of diversity now, the way that people are now being asked to hold up mirrors to various parts of society. And they'll go along with it as long as there's money to be made. This is the sad part of it. The same way as years ago when someone was saying, like, suddenly I did an interview and someone said, we're seeing so many amazing Asian models. And I said, yeah, because these giant luxury brands have realized they can make some bank in China in the way they made bank in Japan. It's purely mercenary. There's no higher aesthetic ideal here for most people.
Yeah.
But if you live in the world, as a person in the world, and you take the subway or you walk down the street or you see people, you look around and say, oh my God, there's been people of all different shapes and sizes and colors all the time.
This whole time.
Who knew? Because, you know, because that's something that's been, you know, leveled quite rightly at fashion for a long time, is the impossibility of the type that we show in print media. The tall, skinny, white woman. We've established this. We get it. We understand it. And now we're doing something else. Or are we doing something else? Are we just doing a version of same? Is the stuff that we're pushing available to people in the world? Like you can say, we're showing these clothes on lots of different body types. For the most part, these body types are also still tall, very beautiful women. But, you know, they're fatter or less skinny than the contemporary model. But then are those things available in the shops? And then, you know, can you buy those things? You see them on the models in the magazines, but can you go, can the, like, say my sister, for example, who actually doesn't have the money for that, but say if she had, could she go down the street and buy something that fits her, like in a size 20-something frame? Probably not.
Yeah.
Which is where the great grace of beauty comes in, because one size does fit all.
That's why I love beauty for that reason. Yeah. It's great. So much more democratic.
But it also trips itself up. It trips, you see, the democracy part of it, the democratic ideal of all, whatever that way of putting it might be about beauty, trips itself up, because I've run into this working with bigger models, a few bigger celebrities. We're still clinging to these strange, God help us, drag-inherited ideas of makeup. So get a great-looking girl of any stripe, fatter, skinnier, larger, smaller, whatever, and you see, for the most part, in their work, in their book, or in their print work, whatever it is, they've been contoured. They've had the nose skinnied and the cheekbone drawn and the shading and all this kind of stuff. And I say, well, if we're really truly embracing the idea of a bigger person, this bigger person has bigger face here, maybe it doesn't. So, can you hear me? Yeah. So I think it's strange. We're working with a wider range of models. So bigger girls, which is great, and amazing girls we've worked with. And that somehow the beauty ideals or things that have been prevalent, like I said, drag inherited beauty ideals for the most part, the contour, the lifting, the taping, the all the stuff.
Wow.
Is also being applied to these faces. And I think, well, is,
like, the face isn't even good enough. The face right. has to be, wow.
Yeah, but so somehow, but then the body is still, so you still have these great boobs and the backside and the legs and all that. Okay, for example, an incredible beauty like Ashley Graham, by anyone's standards, like Ashley Graham looks like Ava Gardner to me.
Yeah,
or, totally. Or Devon, you know, these kind of, these great beauties. And I've seen some people have done work with them, and it's, you know, like, well, so why are we overshading, over contouring stuff? Are we not in the position where we can also say, this is a big person. We don't have to try and make their nose smaller. We don't have to try and do suddenly make the face smaller. Or we do this and that and the other to them. It doesn't seem to make any sense to me. And I'm not sure that if I'm overstepping my way of thinking about things there, or I think it's a legitimate question. Why are we applying skinny person beauty ideas to big people?
I understand.
It's just a question.
Yeah, yeah.
I'll probably get stoned in the street for that.
Something I always, you know, noticed about you since I've, you know, started working in beauty is you never seem to really enjoy, and correct me if I'm wrong, kind of the star, kind of like the starification and the kind of hoopla of the makeup artist as celebrity, and, like, you know, the backstage pandemonium. And, you know, it was never, I've never seen, you know, you've worked with Shiseido, you work with, this line never came to the U.S., but was, how to pronounce it? Inui?
Inui, which was Shiseido. Yeah, it was a domestic line.
Shiseido. Yeah. You know, so you certainly work with brands, but, you know, it was never like Dick Page is unveiling his brand at, you know, Top of the Rock. You know,
no. It was,
you really shied away from that. How come?
I don't know. I'm quite happy to talk about stuff and do my while we're here. I'd like to be more or less invisible as a 6'2", 57-year-old man can be on the subway.
Because you're a big deal. I mean, you've done, you know, hundreds of covers, and you work with every top model. You're as big as it gets, but you really don't. Doesn't feel like it's still like you're in the scene, but you're not like a scenester.
No. Because for the most part, it's not interesting. It's nice to go. It's nice to go nice places and have dinner and do stuff. I'm not really interested in being the front and center of things. I like to do the work. I love to do the work. That's why I'm still doing it. Like I said before, for that moment, that is the most beautiful part of it, is to be able to do that. And then the recording of it is not secondary, because it's how people see it, but it's part of the feeling. It's like working towards creating the picture of the thing. So I'm quite happy to be, I mean, not like Martin Margiela invisible, who people barely even know what he looks like, the designer. Mm-hmm. But, like, to you know, step back a little bit. I don't need to be in the front of things. And as far as the pandemonium goes, I'd rather sit in a bath of acid and hammer nails into my head. Because people aren't seeing this, but, like, the cringe feeling, the shudder of... Well, you've seen the scrum backstage. You've seen having to do all the interviews, all the stuff in the runway shows. And it's a horrible way to work.
You don't seem comfortable.
I know. I mean, I'm comfortable while I can do the thing, but the stampede of it is really unpleasant, and just the crazy rush and push and pull and like the jam. I don't like a crowd in the first place, but to be doing something which is quite a delicate, intimate thing, to be touching somebody's face, and then being, you know, mown down by a horde of cameras or phone waving enthusiasts is a bit terrifying.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Listen, there are so many skincare products on the market claiming to help reduce fine lines and wrinkles, and you know I will try most of them. But how do you know your products are actually working? Some research to back up the claims. That's why Jess and I are all about Ritual. They created a wrinkle support skin supplement and conducted a clinical study to take the guesswork out of skincare. Rituals Hya Sera is now a part of my skincare routine, and I got in the habit of taking it every day by putting the cute little purple jar right next to my sunscreen. It looks nice on my vanity, and let's be honest, I love that. But once I stuck with the habit, I really noticed a difference in my skin. I am not the only one. In a clinical study, taking Hya Sera for 90 days led to a 3.6-time reduction in crow's feet wrinkles as compared to placebo. And it led to a 2.9 increase in skin smoothness. I also like that they're easy to swallow. The capsules sort of taste like vanilla. They're not all weird and fishy like some other supplements. Plus, Ritual is a certified B Corp, something we learned about on a recent episode. And all their supplements, including the Daily Protein and their Sleep Bio Series Melatonin supplement, are vegan, gluten-free, and made traceable. Do what Jess and I did. Start Hya Sera to help minimize wrinkles without compromising on science. Hya Sera from Ritual is a clinically proven skin supplement you can actually trust. Get 25% off your first month for a limited time at ritual.com/mascara. Start Ritual or add Hya Sera to your subscription today. That's ritual.com/mascara for 25% off.
So when did that, we never ever actually talked about this. We had a lot of different, you know, we have a lot of your peers on the show, but I don't think we've ever actually asked this pointed of a question. When did that change? Like, was there a moment of change? Because you've been doing, you know, Backstage Beauty for, you know, so long, but surely there was a moment of like where it went from X amount of people backstage to XXX amount of people backstage. Mm-hmm.
Yes. It was a slow drip, slow sort of erosion of civility. So when I first did my big shows in the early 90s, so I was doing Calvin first and then I started doing Helmut Lang, and it was snowballed. I did a bunch of different shows in different markets. And there were only a handful of photographers, and they were largely the photographers backstage. The few that were backstage were also part of the people who were out front taking pictures of the show itself. But there were way more out the front because that's what people came for. People came, the cult of the backstage thing with the model and the detail and the personality cult of models hadn't really quite taken hold yet, apart from, you know, there was Linda, Cindy, Christine, Amy, then Kate later, some of those girls. But mostly it was the interest was in what went down the runway. Mm. And then it became backstage. It shifted backstage a little bit. And it became about the idea of the girl and what she said and thought about the clothes. And that's when it started to get kind of difficult. Because they weren't really talking to us for the most part. For backstage, there was Elsa Clench, who passed away recently. Elsa Clench was pretty much the only one doing, you know, on-camera interviews with beauty people backstage, makeup and hair. And then Tim Blanks did a little bit before. I think Tim Blanks was working with a Canadian company there. So there are a few people doing interviews backstage, makeup and hair, but not many, not enough to like put you off your stroke. And then the cult of the model, and then the accessibility of different kinds of cameras. So people weren't just walking around with these gigantic video cameras on their shoulders, smashing you in the head. And then I suppose that we really fell over the falls. We went over the falls in the barrel or without a barrel when the phones happened, because we had lots of people with like little kind of like cassette type taping things and then digital taping. And as soon as you could have a scrum, you had a scrum. And then when brands started sponsoring backstage runway shows as well, they needed the coverage. So they sent more people backstage. So it was a slow drip. And then suddenly it felt like, okay, it's a circus when celebrities are coming backstage. The World and His Dog were backstage.
I'm sorry.
Horrible. It was horrible. I mean, then the great thing, a little bit later, you had someone who I was working with on the Celine shows with Phoebe. She didn't have press backstage. It was wonderful. Yeah. It was wonderful. There was no press backstage, and then they let the press in to do first looks, photographs of the models before they went out to do the show. And that was incredible. It was great.
Has it gotten better recently? Because I feel like now, I mean, I'm not doing it right now with my current role, but like, I feel like even the last year or two I was at Bazaar, like, you know, since the pandemic, I was not going too much. Mm-hmm. Do you feel that it's gotten better?
Well, no, we have a whole different set of problems now, of course, with the pandemic, with the testing and the masks and all sorts of stuff. That's another great big subject. I'm sure you've talked about a lot, the distance and the enforced barrier between people. So that limited the numbers of people backstage, but it made everything else that was so difficult, it almost didn't matter because it was nightmare. so unpleasant to work through these layers of all these barriers of where, because what we do is to address the nature of the face. And so to have that intimacy kind of curtailed, it's very difficult. I don't do as many runway shows as I used to. I haven't traveled for runway for a long time. And so the few I do, luckily, have been, they've been kind of fun. They've been some smaller scale. Michael Kors still does an extravaganza, but I've known Michael for so long. That has a nice kind of flow to it. And there is a certain amount of backstage information and stuff going on in there. But I guess I'm not feeling quite as burdened by it because I don't do as much of it.
Yeah. What are you enjoying the most about your job right now?
What I'm enjoying most about my job right now is the constant. It's pretty much the idea, the moment of doing the thing that I do and doing it as well as I can to help make the work beautiful. So I've started working with a few different photographers. If you're lucky enough to try to work with new people as well as the people you established your career with, and just playing. And it's great to, we don't have as much time. Also, the part of the problem is, you may well be aware of, because budgets have been tanked, but so you sometimes being forced to a shoot that might ordinarily have given you 2 days with the attendant grace of time to create looks has been compressed into 1 day very often. But it's nice to be able to play and to work with people and work in with people. That's still my favorite thing, to work with the stylist and the photographer and the hair person and the model and create. So that is a constant. That's probably been pretty much since I started, apart from when I very first started, which was the hysteria. So brilliant. I mean, I kind of love the madness of this, is that when you first begin, you're sweating with all your ideas. But unfortunately, everyone else is sweating with their ideas too. So you get a bunch of sweaty people show up for work, freaking out. They haven't slept. You want to do this. The hairdresser wants to do this. The stylist wants to do this. It's a train wreck. The girl looks like, it looks like, I know, let's make her look like a burst couch that's been set on fire and rolled down a hill. That's the net result. Because no one's holding back. It's hysterical. No one's holding back. Everyone wants to do their thing and make their mark and do the number. And so the poor child, there's a model in there somewhere. So nowadays, there's a bit more, if you're lucky enough to work with people, that who are sympathetic to the creation of pictures, there's a nice dance to it that I step forward, the hairdresser steps back, vice versa. The stylist does something that changes the nature of the piece. The photographer changes the light very slightly. The model comes out in a different shoe. There's something, little subtle shifts of things that are hard to, they're hard to express why they make the change of the moment. Just, or going into set and just, I did the Marc Jacobs thing a couple of seasons ago, where we did a lot of the work creating on set. The look was done and then we changed it a little bit. Like you do, you go in and out and you wipe something off or add something and you build the idea of a picture. And that's an incredible luxury to be able to work like that. And also a luxury to be able to work outside of the parameters of a very strict storyboard or something that comes from an advertising client. Because more often than not, they know which direction the model's facing, and the earring will be doing this, and she should look like this, and this is the, everything has been preordained, and you're sort of at that point a hired hand, hopefully, with the mind to what you can do and do well for a job. So, freedom inside, this is a rambling answer, freedom inside the sphere of creating a look and the moments of application and change and building is something that's still my favorite part of the job, and that's been a constant, that hasn't really changed.
That's wonderful. Is there a face that you love to paint again and again?
There's a lot of faces. What's interesting is if you're lucky enough to work with someone who you've been working with for a while, so you see, I've seen a lot of the girls now, women who have had having more of their lives when you met them when they were quite young, having more of their lives and having families and kids or different types of aspects to their career, or they've moved somewhere else in the world and things have changed for them, and to see how they've changed and who they've become. And your relationship, your friendship, which even if you only see them like once a year or once every couple of years, you have a connection. So someone like, I don't see her very often, working with Margot Jabella. I work with Margot with a bunch of different people with Jürgen a lot. I worked with her a few times with Richard Avedon. Avedon really fell for her hard. I was obsessed with her, which is great to see. So someone like Margot, someone like Kate, of course, the ubiquitous Kate, who is to blame for all of our ills as makeup and hair people, because the thing you do not want to hear when you get to a job is, kind of like Kate Moss. And then you just like, throw your hands up because there's nothing can be done because there's only one Kate. But, it's great because I've known Kate since she was 15. And it's always hilarious and you have fun. And it's great to see her with her kid and her daughter and her life and the way things have changed. But so those become, emotional, personal connections with people. So it's not so much ever really strictly about the face. It's all the attendant stuff. And of course, there are some faces you just can't, you can't believe. I mean, Christy is one of the ones who is, of course, eternally beautiful, because Christy just has this nature of how she is about her. I heard someone describe Christie's beauty as generous one time, and I asked them about it, and they said, well, you know, she's entirely present as a person when you're with her and when she's with other people. And there's no air of otherness about the idea of a beauty. I guess because she's smart enough and canny enough to have understood herself from quite a young age.
Mm.
And, you know, as my mother would say, not got all swell-headed about it.
I don't even really think of her as a model that much. Like, she was a model, but I don't think of her as a model anymore, even though she knows she does model.
Who? Sorry, Christie. Yeah, she comes and does bits and pieces. Sometimes I see her from time to time, and she does what she feels like doing. And I guess she decides to make a couple of bucks here and there, and she'll do it.
But because of all the other work she's done.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. So she's had, she's done incredible work with the charity and all the stuff that she's been doing. I guess that's part of it as well, because she knows, I mean, she probably has realized at one point, like, well, this bit that used to make me completely berserk is the least of my worries. This is something that I can do and have agency of and control of, versus something that I have to do, which really requires blood, sweat, and tears on behalf of other people. So then she thinks, that's like a day off.
It's really cool. Yeah.
Free food. That's what we all do. Every now and then, like, I'm working with Jimmy Paul for doing hair for something, and we get there and we're like, you know, if you're really trapped in a beast and you're having a shit of day, and you look around and you go, like, the food is free. No, they have free soda in a cooler. It could be worse.
That's really funny.
Yeah, it could always be worse.
That's really good. So I feel like you have such a vast, like, encyclopedia of makeup because, you know, you work with Inui. I've seen what you've used. I'm curious about your kit. Are there any odd bits of makeup that you've kept because you know you cannot find something good enough to replace it?
Oh, that's a good question.
I just feel like you have an amazing kit.
I have a very small kit compared to most people.
Okay.
Like, I'm the one with one bag. I'm the one that takes a subway to work.
I love that.
Doesn't happen. Occasionally a backpack. If I want to walk to work, that I'm able, I'll take a backpack. I don't have a massive kit. I get fixations on certain things. And for the most part, they're not from big brands. Occasionally someone will do something in a big brand and I'll be obsessed with it to the point where you have to stockpile it. Hilariously, I have been lately buying things that I made for Shiseido on eBay because, you know, it's quite a few designers ago that I was working with Shiseido. I finished working with them early in 2017. So there's a few things I've run out of, and of course they don't really exist anymore. And sometimes Hiroko Zeki, who worked with me in Japan, has been able to get things for me. But otherwise, I'm on eBay looking for things that I made.
What are these, like, old things? Like, let's talk about some, like, oldies but goodies.
There's a shimmering cream eyeshadow I did for Shiseido that I love. It's not quite a cream to powder, it kind of is. And I did some odd colors. There's a color which is called Sable, which is like a slightly greenish gold bronze beigey color, which is amazing on blonde eyebrows and to line the eyes. It's sort of invisibly kind of tone. Beautiful in blonde eyebrows because, you know, blonde eyebrow colors are better now than they used to be. They used to skew quite red or gray or kind of ashy and dull. So kind of golden, greenish bronze, almost like the kind of the roots of the color of a overpaid Hampton's housewife. Or no need to be paid Hampton's housewife, I don't know. And there's a color called Shoyu, which is based on the Japanese soy sauce. And Shoyu is a very, very dark brown with a bit of trace of pearl in it. And Caviar, which has some different color pearls. And they're just like nice, smudgy, smoothy little things you can paint on. And also, because I mix stuff together all the time, I like cream colors. I don't carry a ton of powder products. I like cream products. And every brand has something magical that you kind of glom onto, and then you can join the legions who are weeping over the discontinued, you know, the discontinued mourning area where we can all go and sit inside and console each other that we'll never find anything like it again. And it's sort of brilliant, like beauty forums, like, do you have a dupe for Chanel Buen Express and it was discontinued in 1986? And I think, you know what? She's still mourning that lipstick that was discontinued in 1986. She has a reason to live. She has purpose. Her life has value because she's still looking for that lipstick.
Her life has value.
Well, one of my sisters is still mourning a Miss Selfridge eyeshadow that I think was discontinued in 1983. And she says, and every now and then she finds something like it and she goes, nah. Let's see. See, Mrs. Frodo, you still have to, you know, your quest continues. And I have those little things, but luckily, I mean, the stuff I get from theatrical brands, you know, I love stuff from Ben Nye and Kriolan and all those brands because they're like mixing the cream colors together and also slightly trickier skin colors because often commercial foundations are not great for in between, like, say, Southeast Asian skin colors. So you need something kind of more greenish or olive-y, certain colours that in a theatre used to be called like a Chinese colour that you can find from Ben Nye or you can find from these brands, because there have always been people in theatre and film who need to be addressed with their proper, their real skin tone. So those things are always there, and luckily they're constant. They don't tend to get discontinued as much because they're serving a different part of the industry. So my kit is quite small, lots of mix and match things, occasional pencils you hang on to. L'Oreal did an amazing thick Kajal pencil, which they discontinued. I think I scored 6 at Monoprix a few years ago in Paris, and they're all gone now. And that just, I don't know, that's just so weird. There's nothing as good as that. So there's a few things.
Okay. But I'm going to ask you one thing in your kit I need to know, because I feel like you always do the most beautiful dewy cheek.
Uh-huh.
Beautiful. What do you use on cheeks?
The top secret,
yeah,
the beautiful dewy cheek is, yeah, not powder.
A cream blush.
No, not powder. Just not powder. Because what happens if you don't powder skin is it shines.
That's the insider tip.
That's the insider tip.
Have a favorite cream blush or something.
It's a lipstick or it's something. I mean, I have a couple of things I've made myself, and I have versions of things left over from Shiseido. But for the most part, it's a lipstick or it's something for the Makeup Forever Flash Color palette, or it's a, okay, Ben Nye. I also, you know, I don't like to carry around a ton of packaging. Sometimes you can find a beautiful item, as you know, when it comes in, you know, it's a frisbee with this much product, yeah, in the middle of it, yeah, you know, so the frisbee size thing has a quarter size piece of product in it. So I don't tend to turn tons of packaging. I like things to be smaller and more portable, compactable. Lipsticks are great for cheeks. But I did a thing for Porter magazine quite a few years ago, mm-hmm, and we photographed Bella Hadid on the beach. And it really was, you know, even by my standards, it was a quick makeup. It was 3 or 4 minutes, quick makeup. And it was hilarious that the response, of course, is the beauty. You know, she's an amazing looking girl. And people were like, what's the highlight? There's no highlight. She has sunscreen on and a little bit of cover up on a couple little marks and stuff. But otherwise, she's in the daytime and the sun is hitting her and she has a highlight. She has a shine. I don't put pearl in the highlights. I very rarely use anything with an actual shimmering.
Yeah, you don't use shimmer. Yeah.
Not so much. I mean, it shows up occasionally in some products that I like the feel slip off, but I'll dilute them. I love it. You know, I love 8-Hour Cream. I love Aquaphor. I love Biopel, the Spanish one from the pharmacy. A little bit of grease will give you a highlight. Most of the effective highlighting thing, if you want to get a little bit technical about it, is contrast. The thing where people trip themselves up with highlights is if everything's shiny, it's really hard to find a highlight. So to make the highlight work, you mattify something else. So it's a question of contrast and reduction rather than addition. Reduction, okay, versus addition. Which is, that's a little bit of math for your makeup heads out there.
No. That's going to send people in. Let's leave them on a deep thought, mm-hmm, and let's close. We have a quick five. It's like 5 questions and just like your quick responses. Let's close on the Fat Mascara 5. Okay.
Okay. Yes.
I do kind of have a slight headache from the math reduction thing. So can I powder my nose and then do like a little balmy highlight?
Yeah, of course. Or is that absolutely? Okay. No, that's the thing. So if you say you powder the T-zone, you powder the forehead, nose, sides, yeah, of the nose a little bit, and the chin, like we do for runway for the most part. If you want, yeah, a beautiful glowing skin for runway, what you don't want is a highlight, headlight, right between the eyes of the skin shining there, or the chin, sure, or necessarily the tip of the nose. So you powder out that stuff, and then your cheek is glowing and gorgeous, and you have that kind of sheen happening.
And that's the Dick Page look. That's what I'm saying. That's where I wanted you on.
Yeah. It's no secret. It's the same. I've been, yes, doing the same makeup for 30 years.
Kind of. It's so
basically
good.
Get, you know, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. Get away with murder.
I mean, that's why people, like, they keep calling you back. They keep calling you back. I mean, but you do, you deliver every time. It's so good. Okay.
Thank you.
Ready? Okay. What music do you like to play on set? If you're in control.
I don't.
You don't like music?
No. I push a little bit of music on set if I'm loose. If my ears are bleeding from whatever else is being played, I'll sometimes try and stage a subtle intervention. But for the most part, yeah. I mean, it's nice if you can create an atmosphere. I did a job with Jürgen Telly years ago with Björk, and I played for Self-Service magazine. And I played the soundtrack to Vertigo by Bernard Herrmann.
Okay.
And she really got into it, and it really helped. I mean, and she said afterwards, like, thanks for DJing. It really made this feeling for the picture, this, like, this strangeness of this soundtrack. So sometimes you want to do something that works with the picture. Obviously, if the model wants to dance, you need to find out what she needs to listen to. When I'm working, I would rather be quiet But that's a kind of an unpopular opinion. Most people would rather have some music backstage. I'd rather not. But on set, pretty much what you need is what your subject needs. So whoever's performing for the camera, and it is a performance, they should get to play what they want. Oh, aren't I generous? That. So generous.
Yeah, that is very generous.
I'm such a kind person. Sorry.
What's your favorite generous beauty? You're a generous beauty, Dick.
I am generous.
What's your favorite fashion show you've ever done?
Oh, wow. It might be one of the Helmut Lang shows in Paris. We did one that was, I thought it looked great because, you know, Helmut liked to mix the cabine of men and women together, and we knew most of the models, and they've changed four or five times, unlike now when models tend to have one look. And we were showing in some market in Paris that was not heated, and everyone had Mylar blankets. It was freezing. And Guido did the hair, and I made the nails. I wanted a matte white nail polish, but it didn't exist, so I used that whiteout stuff that we used to use when we were for typists, mm-hmm. you know, which is probably completely toxic. And because it was so cold, there was like an extra kind of slightly hysterical level of energy. And the models, even though ordinarily fast for a helmet show, they were practically running. And it just had this kind of amazing energy. The clothes were beautiful. Everyone looked great. I just think it was one of those ones where it just kind of came together and everything looked great.
Do you remember around what year that was?
That was probably 96, 97, something like that. I remember Guido did this kind of like, these sort of destroyed Madame French pleat things and stuck feathers in the hair. And it was very beautiful.
Okay, what is the worst question you've ever been asked in an interview? And you can't mention this one.
The worst question. There are so many there's always one coming along that's worse than the one before. The worst question is not strictly a question, but it's a word where people say, what should a woman something, fill in the blanks. What should, you know, which is on, you know, it's on a level with when the magazine says do's and don'ts. I hate the shoulds. All the should questions I really hate. I think I find them very reductive and demeaning to everyone involved. So the should questions. And the one that probably takes the cake is when people say, what's the biggest mistake that women make with makeup? You know, when people ask that question?
Oh, yeah.
Have you asked that question?
I've probably asked that of you over the past 20 years.
But what's the biggest mistake? Because it's also the word mistake sounds so dire. And you think, how bad could it be? You could wash your face.
It's just kind of been like a habit. Like, what's the biggest concealer mistake or blush mistakes?
Yes.
I don't think people think too deeply about it, but I think we need to re-examine and retrain ourselves. Because, it's really reductive and stupid and nasty.
I actually think people do need to think more deeply about it. Because, I mean, surely the onus is on whoever's talking about beauty. The other problem, you probably also understand this and experience of this, is that people talk about beauty in the way that they used to talk about food writing or cookery.
Yeah.
But people didn't take it seriously. So people, like, we watched that Julia show about Julia Child. We just saw the first episode. And she gets very short shrift in the public television station because, you know, beauty, you know, cookery is a woman's subject. And we can't believe we're talking to someone who wrote a cookery book. So, you know, sexist, diminishing, demeaning, insulting, plain rude. Same with beauty. So people, you know, I've been interviewed by people who I can tell I'm halfway through talking to it. They don't really give, can we swear on your podcast?
Yeah, totally.
They don't really give a flying fuck what you think because they, you know, as far as they're concerned, they're a real writer and they're just jobbing doing this. And I think, well, listen, if someone like MFK Fisher, who's a brilliant writer by any stripe, happened to write about food as well as her family and her life in California and in Paris, give it some credit. Ask some interesting questions. Think about your subject. Think about the idea of beauty. It's great writing about beauty from very many people, and Zadie Smith, among others. So these are not short questions, are they, anymore? Sorry, this is not such a book fire round.
No. And I don't mean to say it doesn't matter, but I'm thinking people don't when they're... It deserves attention, but I don't think that it comes from a nasty place, but I think they're just kind of lazy and conditioned. And I'm putting myself in this camp because I know that I've sent those questions off to you.
Uh-huh.
But I don't think I thought like these women are making, you know, terrible mistakes. But yeah, like we need to re-examine it. And I've also been completely underestimated by people in my life because I write beauty. And yeah, I it's all part of the same soup. Yeah.
So just that, like diminishing the idea of something that's so central to what we do, you know, or to who we are rather, because this is, you know, I'm for the gentle listener, I'm waving my hands around my face. this is what we are. We are faces that, you know, we're touchable and we express, and there's so much going on. Great tragedy of the last few years, apart from the obvious tragedy of death and loss, is we've lost half our faces. We've lost half our ways of expression. So beauty is a thing that to not be grave about, but to at least take seriously, to understand that it means a lot to people, how they present themselves to the world.
Absolutely. You mentioned Julia Child. You mentioned food and cooking. You cook a ton. It's a huge passion of yours. What is your favorite comfort food recipe?
It's probably some version of what I had for breakfast. It was leftovers. I had greens and beans, and I poached an egg in it and put some cumin and salt on top. And for some reason, there's something about a pot of cooked greens that is, I find, you know, very comforting. There's also things like a big chunk of bread and butter to dip in it. Like, it's sort of like it's not quite a soup. It's not really a stew. It's just well-seasoned cooked greens.
Nice. And then last, in the movie of your life, who would do the voiceover? Who would narrate?
Oh, Glenda Jackson, please.
You were so at the ready.
Well, she's my favorite voice in the history of voices. And I have a bunch of her records of, like, her, I mean, as an actress on stage and, you know, in film as well, but, like, I have a bunch of her recordings of her reading Emily Dickinson poems. I love her voice. I love the timbre of the voice, the sound of it. Get on with it, because, you know, she's no spring chicken. So, she came back to play King Lear when she was 82. So, Glenda Jackson for the win, always.
Excellent. Dick, thank you so much. This was awesome.
Thank you very much.
We hope you enjoyed the show. It's your reviews and feedback that help us make the podcast even better. Head over to iTunes to rate and review us, or email your thoughts to info@fatmascara.com. We also want to answer your beauty questions and hear what products you love. To share a Raise a Wand product review or to ask a beauty question, email us at info@fatmascara.
If you send it as a voice memo file, we can even share your voice on the podcast. You can also do that by leaving us a voice message. Our phone number in the United States is 646-481-8182.
Thanks so much for listening.